Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 1039 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone back to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here. Much more importantly, Dr. Glenn Berger, PhD, is my very special guest. Never Say No to a Rock Star is the name of his book. And let's get a website where people can kind of follow along, hopefully not while they're driving, but they can follow along either a social media site or a general website. What can you give us, Doctor?
Yeah, my login is at www.glennberger.net. That's GlennBerger, glennberger.net.
Let's get back to Phil Ramone. What a fascinating character, and I mean that with the greatest respect when I say character, a fascinating individual. And to be talking to someone who worked with him from the lowest levels of working with him to the highest levels of working with him, and somebody who actually is a psychotherapist, to be around a guy like that who was, certainly highly neurotic and great at the same time. Let's go back to the question, what made Phil Ramone great?
Well, of course, one thing that sort of separated the good from the great was the ability to hear a hit, and that's what they called having great ears. And we were Phil was asked to co-produce an album by this vocal group. It was being produced by his friend Milt Oken. Milt had done a lot of work with Phil with Peter, Paul, and Mary. Milt went on to work with John Denver, and he was bringing in his new act, and Phil was going to co-produce. But I think Phil got the whiff that this was not going to be a big hit act that was going to propel his career. He was on the verge of becoming a producer at that point, hadn't started working with Billy Joel yet. And so when Phil didn't really feel a project, he would pass it on to his prodigies. So he passed it on to a guy named Rich Blakin, who had worked with Phil and myself. And we were going to do the album, and Phil would kind of blow into the control room every once in a while. He would be out in the hallway. He'd be trying to soothe Barbara Streisand, who'd be having a fit, or he'd be booking his next session with Chicago, or whatever he was doing out there. And he'd come into the control room just to see how things were going, and then he'd run out again. One time he comes into the control room, and he says, okay, this is what you do. You get a pedal steel guitar, you put it through a flanger and a fuzz box, and when they say Skyrockets in Flight, have it do a descending gliss, and this will be a number one hit record. Now, I thought this was a typical Ramone lunacy. You know, that first of all, I thought the record was a turkey. I thought this was right into the $1.99 bin. This was a flop record. It was this middle-of-the-road kind of country rock thing that I was listening to John Lennon and Brian Eno at the time. I would know how to kind of space out while working on an album if I didn't think it was very good. And I thought, this Ramone is a nut. And it kind of annoyed me because not only did I think it was silly, but it meant that we were going to have to actually do some work. We were going to have to set this up. But when Phil Ramone spoke, of course, we all listened, right? So we get in the pedal steel player, we do the thing, we do the descending gliss. It turns out to be a song called Afternoon Delight by the Starland Vocal Band, which was one of the biggest hits of the 1970s.
And it still gets played. Like I saw on Arrested Development. I knew as soon as you said the line what song it was. Arrested Development, they sang it in karaoke. It gets brought up and it gets picked up, I think, because of the double entendre, and you would never know it from the kooky sound of it. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Exactly right. I mean, it's been in a couple of movies. It was in the movie with Steve Carell, and it pops up all over the place. And they were a one-hit wonder. How did Phil know that? He heard this. He was out in the hallway on the telephone, and he heard it. I missed it completely. That's why I'm not Phil Ramone. That's why I'm a psychotherapist today. And that was one of his extraordinary talents and abilities, that he could hear a hit from a mile away and know just the perfect use of ear candy to put in there to just send it over the top and make it a hit. Yeah, I mean, it took me years before I figured out what that song was really. I didn't even not only not know that it was a hit, but I didn't even realize that it was a song about sex for who knows how long.
That just sounds like such a goofy, silly song.
It is, exactly.
Yeah. Well, let me again remind people of who they're listening to. Dr. Glenn Berger is the author of Never Say No to a Rock Star, and he's been around so many of the greats in rock and roll and music and entertainment. everywhere. And never say no to a rock star. Please pick it up. And Frank McKay here, but more importantly, Dr. Glenn Berger is our very special guest. We're talking quite a bit about Phil Ramone, the great record producer Phil Ramone. Was there anyone that he was in awe of? Was there anyone that he was just like not himself with? What was his vulnerabilities?
He was a very vulnerable guy. It was interesting when I mentioned before that we were working with Mick Jagger. You probably are quite familiar with this, but there used to be a radio show back in those days called the King Biscuit Flower Hour.
Sure.
And they would have basically live broadcasts of the great groups of the day on the radio. And the Stones had recorded some shows in Brussels in 1973. Jagger didn't think that those recordings were good enough for an album, so he decided that he would use them for the King Biscuit Flower Hour. So Jagger came in to supervise the mix. Bob Meyerowitz was the guy from King Biscuit, and Phil was the engineer, ostensibly, on those sessions, and I was the assistant. And Phil was usually very possessive of his console. You didn't touch the knobs when Phil was seated at the desk. But when Jagger came in, Phil stood up and let Mick actually do the mix, which I never saw before and I never saw since. So clearly, wow. he was. Yeah. He would also kind of read the room. He was very he was very intuitive in that way. And when we were working with Dylan, it's a lot that in the story of what it was like to record Blood on the Tracks. Phil was quite intimidated by Dylan. Again, he was not the producer on that record, although some people say that was the case. He was really the engineer. And so, for example, while Dylan was playing, his guitar or something was, I think, hitting a button on his vest, and it made a sound that you would never accept in a recording. And in any case, the engineer would hit the talk back and say, "Your button's hitting the guitar, we got to do another take." And that would be a no-brainer. Phil was too intimidated to say that to Dylan, so the recordings, you can still hear the clacking of the button on his guitar.
I mean, did Dylan pick up on it? Did he at least point out that it was there? Or?
No. Dylan was completely... He was very uninterested in the production of that record. Maybe all of his... I have no idea what...
Which is amazing, because it's an amazing album.
Yes, absolutely.
What's the psychology that comes to mind when you talk about a Bob Dylan? What's your first, you know, if we're doing like word association with Bob Dylan, and I don't mean a single word, but if I'm asking you to give a thought on Bob Dylan, what would you say?
I would say that he was inspired. He was an inspired genius who had no real, at least when I worked with him, he was so involved in his artistic pursuit that nothing else existed around him, so he could treat people horribly. In fact, what happened, one of the things that happened, he came into the studio, said, "We're going to do this session. Could you find some musicians for me?" That's how uninvolved he was. He just let Phil pick some.
Wow.
Phil saw Eric Weisberg in the hallway and said, "Hey, can you get a band together?" And so Eric Weisberg and the Deliverance band came in. Eric Weisberg had played the soundtrack for the film Deliverance, and the band that had played on that, he called the Deliverance band, and these guys came. These were top studio cats. And, of course, we were all incredibly jazzed that we were going to be working with Bob Dylan, right? Dylan, we were told not to talk to him, to give him his space. So we were very careful around him, and I bring him out into the studio and set him up in front of the mics. And he starts running down a tune. Now, there was no arranger for this thing. So what studio cats would do is they would learn the song, and they would come up with what we would call a head arrangement. They would kind of invent the parts. And usually it took time. It could take hours before you really honed in on the optimal arrangement for a particular song. So the cats are just beginning to learn the song. They do one rundown. Dylan says, "Let's roll tape." Now, there's that spontaneous thing. Of course, we're ready to roll the tape. We do. Dylan goes through the song one time, and we think we're going to do take number two. because the guys are barely know the thing, and he starts playing a different song without even telling the studio musicians that he's going to play a different song. The musicians stumble. They start playing the wrong chords. They don't realize what's happening. As soon as one of the musicians plays a wrong chord, Dylan waves him off like he was swatting a bug and tells him to drop out. Within minutes, all of the band are sitting behind their instruments, not playing. And the energy in the room went from, oh my God, we're playing on a Dylan album, to, oh my God, we're not playing on a Dylan album. And he basically fired the band on the spot. He did most of the tracks with the just with the bass player, a guy named Tony Brown. And Tony sat inches from Dylan's hands and had to watch where he was putting his fingers on the fretboard to figure out what the next chord was going to be. And it was and it was especially difficult because Dylan was working with a guitar tuning that wasn't the traditional tuning, so the fingers weren't even going where they normally would go. But Tony Brown was able to kind of follow that, and you know, and that's the way we cut those tracks. So Dylan, you know, he just was oblivious to the impact that he was having on the musicians. But you know, then I'd see him write a song, and write it in a book. It was like he was taking dictation from a higher source. I mean, he was clearly tapped in.
Yeah, no question about it. Dr. Glenn Berger, PhD, is our very special guest. Never Say No to a Rock Star is his book. Please, we encourage you to get it. Is it your first book? And pardon my ignorance.
This is my second book. I have a children's book at that as well called Princess Shantique and the Outside World.
Well, you mentioned royalty, and again, Frank McKay here with Dr. Glenn Berger. You mentioned Princess there, and you also mentioned Prince early on. Did you ever have the time or the privilege or whatever? He would look at it as a privilege for sure, of playing with Prince, the late Prince?
You know, I didn't, and there's certain artists that I'm glad that I never worked with. I know too much about the ones that I did work with. Some of the artists I worked with, of course, were really lovely people, and I respect all the artists that I work with. But sometimes it's better to keep somebody in that zone of being a fan, you know, not really knowing the inside stuff. So, no, I didn't get a chance to work with Prince.
Well, let me, you know, just make one comment on Prince. And again, I a very talented guy, no question, played a lot of instruments, wrote many songs that did very well. I had a problem, and again, I'm not even, you know, that hung up on all of this, but I had a problem with him writing Slave on his face, right? I mean, I think he died with a $300 million or $200 million net worth, or I don't know what it was, but Slave. I'd love for somebody at that time to have given him a history lesson to what an actual slave was and still is in certain parts of the world, and slave trade. But he wrote Slave, and I've heard different stories. I mean, one was about him not getting his masters, but someone said it prior to that. It was him. Him complaining about adding some shows, but I mean, again, a history lesson is needed by some of these guys. Give me somebody, if you can. I don't know if you can give me somebody who's just horrendous to work with.
Horrendous to work with. Well, you know, frankly, and a lot of this is in the book, and I hate to do this to folks because these are heroes. But I mean, this is about people's heroes, and again, I recognize the complexity of the characters. But Paul Simon was very difficult to work with. He was quite cold.
I would think so. I would think he would be. I don't think he seems like a relaxed guy or anything like that. I think he seems. Is he a prima donna?
Yeah, I think one of the things with artists like that when they make it so young is they don't learn the necessity of treating people well. They're given permission to be prima donnas. You know, they're supported in doing that. So he was certainly that. And again, I think that he was so focused on what he was doing and getting the outcome that he was looking for musically that he just didn't, again, really see the people that he worked with as human beings. And it wasn't his obligation to do that. So basically treated me like a well-trained monkey. And that's you know, that was basically my job anyway. So I really couldn't complain about that. But I saw him do some pretty cold things, and pretty much anybody that worked with him would agree that, I mean, you know, of course, one of the things that we loved doing in the studio was talking about the artists, right? Because they were all extreme characters, and Simon had a pretty bad reputation in that regard.
Yeah, that's not surprising to me. Let's talk about the other end of it. I mean, there's so many people out there that you listen to or you hear. I mean, I worked with more unsigned musicians than I could ever imagine. I managed a lot of folks, known and not known. But the ability to get beyond that fear of failure or that fear of rejection, in your mind, and again, you're an expert at this. This is your expertise. Again, reminding people, Dr. Glenn Berger's a PhD. The name of the book is Never Say No to a Rock Star. Frank McKay here with Dr. Glenn Berger. But on that same note, is that the biggest problem that you see to folks who just don't achieve or they underachieve? Is that fear of failure, that fear of rejection, criticism?
Certainly the fear of failure is a big one, and the fear of rejection. The fear of humiliation is huge. And I work with a lot of artists now in my psychotherapy practice. Some are quite successful, obviously some more so than others. I would have to say that even bigger than the fear of failure and rejection is the fear of success. And it really goes to that fraud thing that you were talking about before, is that people have a very hard time grappling with the possibility that they could be tremendously successful, that they really have great worth. And I think that underneath the fear of failure is that even bigger fear. But and observing the greats' work, I would say that some of the qualities that they had was, and I think Paul Simon fits into this category, and this was one of his great strengths, was his ability to endure pain. The perseverance I saw in a guy like Fosse or Paul Simon or lots of great folks that I work with was Steely Dan. When I worked with Steely Dan, they would work on a basic track for 12 hours and they would redo it if one cymbal hit wasn't in the right place. When I would be ready to say, that's it, it's good enough, it's fine, it's great, they would say, one more, let's do it again. They were in pursuit of something, and no matter how exhausted, no matter how difficult, no matter what the pain was involved, they endured, they persevered, and I think that more than sort of fancy flights of creative inspiration, it was that perseverance in dogged pursuit of this vision that separated the greats from the rest of us. And I think that that's another big part of what the people who don't make it struggle with, is that they don't have that passion that's going to endure, the willingness to endure suffering and pain.
I have obviously, no formal training in psychology or anything along those lines, but I always, just from a layman's standpoint, I changed my thinking on it, but I always used to look at fear of success as just like a disguised fear of failure or fear of criticism. But someone explained to me, and I'm going to ask your take on this. A fear of success is, a lot of people out there saying, well, what would they be afraid of? Why would you be afraid of success? There's bigger expectations for you there. What if I'm not up to it? What if I get there and it's the Peter principle? Is it all of that, or is there something else to a fear of success?
Yeah, I think it's all of that and more as well, which is, if we all carry around a map inside of us of who we are and what the world is. And when information comes in that doesn't match that map, we either change the map or we reject the information. So if we all walk around somewhat with this feeling of inadequacy, when information that comes in that says, no, you're not inadequate, in fact, you're spectacular, it doesn't fit the map. And a lot of times people have to get rid of that. We hear all the time people have a hard time taking a compliment, something as simple as that, right? So it becomes it really brings up a lot of conflict when the world gives us sort of that positive response, when inside we don't feel that way. So some people overcompensate, like a Bob Fosse, who just strives for more and more greatness, and that's his way of dealing with that insecurity. But most people will shy away from success because it doesn't fit their self-concept.
Dr. Glenn Berger, we have about a minute and a half left with you. We need time for a part two and a part three. And, you know, hopefully later in the year we'll catch up and get an update on Never Say No to a Rock Star, which is a must read for everyone. Frank McKay here with Dr. Glenn Berger. Let me ask you this, and again, it's probably unfair to ask it with about a minute left. Any tying traits to all these great people that you've worked with? Is there any common traits that you could see between the Fosses and these Paul Simons and the Dylans and the Phil Ramones? Is there any trait that you think they all have, or you feel they all have?
Yeah, you know, another person that I work with that I just want to mention is Judy Collins. And I worked with Judy on the Judas album. Sending the Clowns was on that record. And she put together the most extraordinary team for that record. Reef Martin was the producer, who was astounding, and Phil was the engineer. And the trait that she had was a standard of excellence. She had impeccable taste. And there was always this pursuit of excellence. And I think that whether it was Phil Ramone or Bob Fosse or Judy Collins or Steely Dan or any of these folks, that was their religion. Our religion was that standard of excellence. We just wanted to do the absolute best that we could. You know, they'd say close enough for rock and roll, but that was always ironic. We were trying to achieve greatness, and sometimes we got lucky and we did.
It's more than luck. I tell you, it's just a great story. Never Say No to a Rock Star is the name of the book. Congratulations on all your success, Dr. Glenn Berger. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank. This was a lot of fun.
Same here. Dr. Glenn Berger has been our very special guest. He is the author of Never Say No to a Rock Star. Please get this. And you can get him at, give us the site again, Dr. Glenn Berger. What's your website?
GlennBerger.net. GlennBerger.net.
Frank McKay signing off. We'll see you all next time on Breaking It Down.